and welcome to the latest installment of Lisa and Phil Ruin the Movies, or Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies, depending on who kicks off this podcast. Since it's me, it's Lisa and Phil. Mm. I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
I am Philip Michaels.
And we are super excited today. We've got three new trailers to ruin for you. Mm-hmm. And we have the much-promised follow-up to our last podcast, thanks to the generosity of Listener David.
Yes, Listener David, no last name.
No.
So if you are a fella named David listening to this podcast, you can like play this and boast that it was you and that was generous.
Gifted us burnt.
Yes. Gifted. Air quotes.
Anyway, thanks.
I feel that we...
Thanks to his generosity. Yes. We did watch it.
He's a very generous man, and he had some very nice words to say about the podcast. I just want to back up here before we delve into this. Uh-huh. I feel that we set our sights really low as to asking people to do stuff. I feel that we kind of shortchanged ourselves saying, hey, send us $5 to watch a terrible movie. Yeah, the joke's kind of on us there. I feel that maybe we should have said, hey, pick up our mortgage or buy us a nice dinner or something.
And the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
Exactly.
And our journey of 1,000 miles has begun with Bradley Cooper's big career misstep.
Oh my goodness, this movie.
But we're going to get to that after we dissect three new previews for you. Phil, which review would you like to give first?
Let's get Civil War America. What's so civil about captains, anyhow? There's a new Civil War trailer.
There was Civil War.
And America is talking of nothing else. Mm-hmm. Because, you know.
Well, everyone's in it at this point.
I don't need no Civil War. They feed the rich while they bury the poor.
Axl Rose once said. He's not in the trailer. He's possibly the only person
He might be behind the Spider-Man mask.
He might be.
That's Axl. Hey. No, actually, it would be a much larger, beefier Spider-Man if it were Axl Rose. we all age, Axl.
There's no shame in it.
I'm bigger than I was in 1988, too, so.
There's no shame in it. Mm-hmm. And we saw trailer number, this is the official trailer number 2. Mm-hmm. And I believe the last time we talked about this, I was like, well, I'll see it because Marvel completist. But now I'm.
Now you're enthused.
I am enthused about it. Yeah. And I was going through the trailer trying to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because I am super curious about, one, I'm super curious about how they're going to work Spider-Man into this. It's evident from the trailer that he's hanging out with Tony Stark. But this is the same dude who's like, we all need to be reined in. And so to do that, he's recruiting teenagers to beat up superpowered people. So I'm interested to see how that shakes out. Also, interested to see how Ant-Man gets integrated into this. Because one of the
There's a little shot of Ant-Man.
I know! And it's so cute and so awesome. And one of the things that made Ant-Man so appealing last summer was how it was set in the same universe, but not of it. The Avengers were something that happened to other people. They were front page news. And they were basically a different weight class than the Ant. Mm-hmm. And to see him with the Avengers here, I'm trying to figure out how they're going to write that in so it's plausible. And I'm trying to figure out also the ratio of Paul Rudd. Like, how many days was Paul Rudd on the set? You know? Like, was he there for 2 days and then did, like, 2 days worth of voice work and it was all special effects? Or what the deal is? And more importantly, does this take the character out of the comedy pot, as it were? Because, again, like, the two Marvel movies.
Oh, it's a dour-looking trailer.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And it's got the tinkly piano of sadness playing.
At least they're not.
As Captain America has his long tea time of the soul. And
well, I think you kind of have to do that because, oh my gosh, it's the family is having an argument or what have you. Mm-hmm. And
Mom and Dad are fighting and they have superpowers.
My hot dads are fighting. I don't know what to do. Yeah.
That was my favorite NBC sitcom of the 80s, My Two Hot Dads. With Greg Evigan and Ant-Man.
Paul Rudd.
No! trying to
bring it all back in. Yeah. Well, the other thing I'm interested in is one of the problems that's sprung up in the MCU as it's gotten bigger is that the Avengers movies are all, oh, an old team is together. But the problem after the first one, you and I went to see Iron Man 3, and the whole time we were cracking jokes about, well, where are his Avenger friends? Right. Like, is Nick Fury just, like, no longer returning Tony Stark's calls? Is Natasha on a beach somewhere where she gets no reception?
Right.
The reason this movie kind of excites me is because I feel like it will finally address that concern and explain why these guys do or don't live out of each other's back pockets. Because that's, structurally speaking, that's something they haven't been able to reconcile in the movies yet. And I'm also super excited about seeing T'Challa.
Who is that for those of us who...
Chadwick Boseman dresses like a cat.
Okay, it's not the course of action I would have taken, but whatever makes Chadwick Boseman happy, I suppose.
Yeah.
And we
loved him in that movie Baseball is Racist.
That wasn't the name of the movie. 42.
I couldn't remember the name of the movie.
You could have called it the Jackie Robinson story, not we love the movie Baseball is Racist.
That was the subtext of the whole movie, and the text of the whole movie.
It was
because it's Jackie Robinson getting a hard time from everybody.
It was the breaking of the color barrier in baseball. The way you said it, it was like, yes, baseball is racist as ever, and God bless it.
No. I feel like Jason Sudeikis would be the lead in that role, actually, where he'd just have this big poop-eating grin on his face. Baseball, we love baseball.
Well, had Alan Tudyk in that movie as the horrible Chapman.
Yeah. Oh.
Which, you know, was a great performance, but boy, oh boy, don't include that in your clip reel.
I was super uncomfortable watching.
That was a very uncomfortable thing. And
although all he had to do really was kind of just read Adam Baldwin's Twitter feed aloud and make the same flavor.
And Harrison Ford under about 8,000 pounds of latex.
I can't.
Jackie, you're going to break the baseball column.
I can't.
Hey, baseball is
I think I've made my feelings known about old Harrison Ford already, and I just don't want to.
At least it was a movie where his natural crankiness
worked for him.
Yeah.
I always wonder what it's like at the Harrison Ford Calista Flockhart house.
You know, perhaps he's all laughs away from the public eye.
I think he
anyhow, we're getting far afield.
So I'm excited about Civil War because, to me, it seems to address one of the head-on problems with the MCU, which is the whole, where are your friends when you're in trouble, solo hero. I'm also excited because it seems to continue the evolution of Tony Stark into a real human boy. And I think it's going to point out... I think the problem is when you have the name Captain America, you tend to think that it stands for a certain type of unthinking, reflexive patriotism in the service of the government of the country. And Steve Rogers is actually somebody who has a pretty well-established record in comics, too, where he's not loyal to institutions, he's loyal to ideals. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out across the canvas of this movie. I'm also super interested to see who the double agents on either side are, because you know there's going to be like one or two double crosses. So I'm excited about this because I think it's actually thoughtful.
Okay. I think this is where we insert Phil's standard complaint about comic book movies and my lack of interest in them.
Well, you're not going to go see it.
No, I'm not going to go see it. The whole scene where all the Avengers are rushing at each other, that seems tactically unsound.
Well, yeah, okay, you know, you heard me mutter when we saw that scene, and I muttered a bunch of tactical geniuses in the bunch and running at each other as their battle plan. I think it's because it's going to look really... It's one of those...
Oh,
it's going to look really cool.
It looks nifty, but like...
No,
it's,
that's...
It's the Pickett's charge
I don't understand.
Of superhero battles.
Like, if you have an archer, you should just like tuck him up in a corner somewhere and let him pick off people from the sky. And I don't understand why, like, unless Renner's contract has something in there, well, he needs to be sprinting. That's his thing. He feels very strongly about being shown sprinting in movies.
And and the fact that Steve Rogers is not just a reflexive knee-jerk guy means that my dream of Progressive Red Skull is never going to materialize.
Oh, Steve Rogers! Everyone needs a living wage!
You're right, Red Skull. That's why I'm teaming up with you in the Low Pay Is Not Okay initiative to make sure that our service workers have a basic salary. I implemented this in Massachusetts first. Why do they keep calling it the Captain America plan?
It's based on a Heritage Foundation recommendation, for Christ's sake!
Little potty mouth there, Progressive Red Skull.
Oh, be quiet!
Don't you police my language.
Your microaggressions are...
You know, I'm now imagining if a secret evil organization was run by the people who were on Tumblr.
Yeah, sure.
They just kind of reblog minute notes at every mini meeting.
Yeah, there you go. So that's, I think that's...
I think we've talked enough about the trailer.
That's Captain America 2, 3.
It's 3.
Captain America 3, yeah. Civil War.
Yeah.
I also would like it if they, if Ken Burns directed it, and it's just black and white stills. Dearest Natasha, I fear that I will never see you again.
And it's narrated by the different actors.
Yeah. Mm. So there you go.
Yeah. Narrated by Patton Oswalt, actually. All parts.
Great.
That's a shout out to the TV thing where he plays like 3 different roles.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Angry Birds we saw trailer for. Yeah. Which seems like we saw that about 3 years, 4 years after there should have been an Angry Birds movie.
Yeah, to reference Patton Oswalt for the second time in under a minute,
yeah,
there's a routine he does, and I can't remember which album it is.
But, I believe it is his second one.
But he talks about how to make money, he punches up comedy scripts, especially for animated movies, and then explains over the course of the routine that one of the challenges is computer-generated animation is expensive, and generally you're
brought in after the movie is more or less in the can,
and you're discouraged from can you reanimate that, so you're stuck.
You're basically adding in jokes in the background or little audio gags, and you're not reworking the script in the traditional
in
sense.
Any way you're basically just kind of watch the hand, oh, this is funny, well, please ignore the glaring plot holes or what have you. And this entire trailer felt like it was one radical reworking of a much different movie, and the reworking was no better.
Yeah.
I don't have a good feeling about this movie.
No, and...
And look, I have a high tolerance for dumb films, and I also have a high tolerance for animated films, and I have a high tolerance for kids' films, and you and I saw Minions with our daughter, for God's sake.
I saw Zootopia just last weekend, and it was fine.
Yeah.
It was a fine little production, although the bodies of the animals are weirdly proportioned. They all have...
Did they anthropomorphize them?
They all have, like... all the predators have, like, these sort of triangular physiques where they all have the big, broad chests.
Oh, they're like little Doritos.
And the very thin waists. And that was aesthetically displeasing to me.
Although, like, what I didn't realize until recently is kangaroos are, like, the jacked-up ride users of the marsupial world. Like, you look up pictures of them, and they are... yoked.
Yeah.
It is crazy what they're doing out in the outback. I don't know if they're just... Oh, it's unnerving.
Anyhow, Zootopia was rather pleasant and rather well thought out. And that was one of the... if you know the backstory of the movie, they actually did redo that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because the original story wasn't working. They cast it more from the perspective of the rabbit, who's voiced by Jennifer Goodwin.
Yeah.
Of Goodwin's Law fame, and
that's right. She invented the rule about internets and Nazis.
Yes, that and was, then went on and to then went on to become an actress.
No, but apparently her performance was soulful and funny.
Yeah, yeah, and it was quite good.
And that helped something click in the writers' room where they're like, okay, this is not working from the perspective of the scoundrel / antihero. Let's rewrite it from the perspective of the little person who has to deal with the scoundrel.
Yeah, and that was quite good. And I bring that up to contrast it to Angry Birds, which looks like a cash grab where they got sidetracked on the way to cash the check.
Well, it's never a good sign when the central conflict is our man slash bird feels alienated because he's got enormous eyebrows. And I thought, you live in a bird society that has bird schools and bird jobs, and surely there are bird aestheticians that can wax those eyebrows and solve all of your problems. Why is this even a thing now?
I don't think that is the source of his anger.
He feels isolated. Yeah, He's out of step, blah, 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 and then pigs come. And then,
yes, exactly.
And
so it's the 2016 election. Maybe it is in time. Maybe it's the film America not only needs but deserves.
Slate editors, this is my husband's pitch for later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't feel good about it. We're not going to take our daughter to see it.
No.
I can't even say that we would solicit tickets on this podcast to go see it because
absolutely not.
No.
And, At Disney, I noticed a few Angry Birds shirts when we were at Disneyland a few weeks.
Yeah, but I noticed a few shirts with all manner of stuff on
them. Yeah, yeah. It's just I've seen less Angry Birds gear, I think, at the moment in the zeitgeist has passed.
Well, there's so many more games now.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, why would you cling to a game that was released a few years ago when there are other newer franchises
it crested when our daughter was
two
one.
Oh wow, yeah.
So this is 4 or 5 years past its sell-by date,
yeah,
or past its peak popularity.
I mean, I'm hesitant to write it off altogether with pie, it will never work, because I would have said the same thing about a movie based on Lego minifigs, and the Lego movie is enjoyable. And something that we could actually go see in a theater, because it's got humor for all levels. So who knows with this, but the trailer's not promising, and it's a little weird to peg your movie to something that crested 5 years ago.
Right.
So that was what, 90 seconds of our time that we grimaced at the screen? Mm-hmm. And then we moved on to Keanu,
which is
the movie that Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele wrote, wherein one of them adopts an adorable kitten named Keanu. The cat gets stolen, and these two nerds have to go retrieve their adorable kitten.
Mm-hmm.
I will freely admit that the trailer won points with me the minute it opened up with the opening strains of George Michael's Father Figure, because that song is just ridiculous. And the juxtaposition of using Father Figure to introduce a kitten is like, it hits all my absurdity buttons. That said, I don't know if Key and Peele humor translates past a few minutes of a sketch. Like, they do great sketches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really sorry their sketch show is over, because it was super funny. They had a commitment to the concept. They had a commitment to detail. Their costuming team was great. They are subtle and broad simultaneously. Keegan-Michael Key is a gifted physical performer. But I don't know how that works across the canvas of a story that's supposed to unfold over 90 minutes.
The problem with translating any sketch comedy thing to a feature length is that can the sketch comedy people sustain it for 70 to 90 minutes or more? That was the other thing. I just to backtrack to Civil War.
Yeah.
I had read a headline this week. It's going to be the longest Marvel movie ever. And that,
it is. And oh, that, my God.
That broke my soul.
I'm bringing in a meal.
Yeah. So, but to back up to Key and Peele, again, they're very gifted at the sketch comedy. It'll be interesting to see if you can sustain that writing level and that interest level over the course of a feature. All signs point to no. It strikes me as it's going to be one of those movies where it's very hit and miss.
Yeah.
And then if the previous 5 minutes of the movie don't grab you, maybe the next five will.
It might be the kind of movie that plays better on cable.
Yeah.
Or on demand, when you can watch it in your own house and it's infinitely gif-able, or there are clips that play on YouTube well.
Yeah.
And this actually raises another interesting question about the art and craft of movie making, which is whether or not the slice and dice remix culture that's emerged as both a form of fandom and a form of criticism, whether that's actually beginning to affect how people make movies.
Yeah, maybe.
And that's something I'm kind of interested in chewing over. I don't have a definitive, yes, it does affect, or no, it does not. But we are definitely in the throes of a profound remix culture, and one where people do not hesitate to take a specific character or a specific scene and then explain all of the cultural influences that went into it. So what I wonder sometimes is if the movies that find second life, like Zoolander, for example, which got its legs through cable, or Ricky Bobby is another one. Talladega Nights, that was called.
Yeah, Anchorman too.
Yeah, I wonder
if Anchorman, TOO.
Oh yeah.
Because
I wonder if those movies do so well precisely because they lend themselves well to deconstruction and remixing. But if you have a movie that is inherently deconstructed and remixable, who receives that well, or who doesn't receive that well, and why, are the questions that I'd like to try and answer.
What were your feelings about the Kids in the Hall movie? Brain Candy.
Oh, God, Brain Candy.
1996
Yeah. 95. With Gleeman Ox.
Yeah.
There are still parts of that movie that pop up in weird situations. Like, anytime I'm in a meeting with somebody who is attempting to sell a very unpopular idea,
mm-hmm.
and they are ignoring all criticism and persisting in their original line of thought, like, to stay sane and not say anything, I instantly flash back to, it's a pill that gives ex-girlfriends worms!
Mm-hmm.
And I stay there.
Yeah.
But my sense is when they made that movie, it was basically, wouldn't it be funny if this happened, and then this, and it was kind of like a loosely collected string of anecdotes.
Yeah.
But, no.
To me, that was...
That's the hazards of sketch comedy.
Illustrates the hazards of translating a sketch comedy thing to the big screen.
Well,
we're possibly being unfair, because it's not like they're doing their sketch show in a movie. They're trying to do a feature-length movie. It's just, we know them primarily from doing, like, little 3-minute, 4-minute bits.
Well, it's different writing is what it comes down to. Is a genuinely funny movie is one where you have to be patient and wait for the long payoff,
mm-hmm.
in a way, or you have to build, like... But the point is there has to be a period where you lay down the foundation and you lay down the work and you have to trust the audience to be patient with you.
Right.
Whereas the thing about sketch comedy that is amazing is you throw your audience into this fully formed premise, expect them to catch up, and then hit them sideways with the denouement.
Yeah, yeah.
So now that we've talked about comedy and therefore made it incredibly unfunny.
Yeah.
Let's
talk about how sausage is made. First you take sheep bits.
Speaking of food-related stuff.
Oh, man.
So how about that Bert?
Yeah. So, previously on Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies, I had watched Burnt on a Plane. I should mention I did not watch all of Burnt on a Plane because this was the second movie I watched on the Madrid to Dallas leg of my return from Europe. The first I had watched was Spectre, and I sort of watched Burnt after talking myself into it. Like, oh, what the hell else am I going to do on this flight? I'm brain dead.
Yeah.
And I was struck by how terrible it was.
Uh-huh.
And I had only seen, it's about 110...
It's an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, so it's 100 minutes. And I had seen about 70 minutes, maybe 65.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not know how it ended.
Mm-hmm.
And in this era of movies where everything is test marketed to a fault.
Yeah.
And everything is the rough edges are buffed off and you really... At a certain level of studio release, you see movies that don't work or aren't very good or that slip right... But most movies just slip right off the brain pan.
Yeah.
There are not movies that you just...
They're so focus-tested as to be unremarkable.
Yeah. You don't sit there and watch and go, oh my goodness, this movie is horrendous. Mm-hmm. And you can see every bad decision up there on the screen. And that was... what grabbed me about Burnt and why I wanted to force you to watch it and why listener David was
kind enough,
air quotes, to he was kind.
And to take a
we
moment,
we asked him to do it and he did it.
Well, we didn't ask him specifically, but I think what this actually illustrates is our audience, whom we've abused terribly by not putting on a regular production schedule prior to 2016, and who have hung in there with us anyway and have been nothing but supportive.
Yeah, very nice folks.
The point is that people have risen up and said, oh, okay. And
given us a little of our own back, abused us in return.
Well, I want to thank the audience for their engagement with us. I want to thank you guys for listening.
That was very nice, because he was not the only person who offered.
Yeah.
Which means you are very cruel people.
Well, look at the title of the podcast and what they're listening
to.
Yeah. We found our people.
Yeah.
They found us.
Quite true.
Yeah.
I don't want to really do a major plot recap of Burn, because that's not why people listen here. I can do the 30-second plot recap.
Oh, I can do one in 10.
Okay, you do it.
Undeserving white man gets way too many chances to succeed despite having no record of accomplishment or personal character.
Okay, again, you've described 60% of the movies on the market today. And every candidate but one or two on the 2016 election. So let's let's give a little bit more body to that description. Okay. Bradley Cooper was a famous rock star chef in the Gordon Ramsay, Marco Pierre White, two Michelin star mode. He became a drug addict and a horrible wastrel and was run out of the business. And now he's back, baby, to get that third Michelin star. And so it's a tale of redemption, Phil? Oh, no. He's still a horrible jerk. He just doesn't drink anymore.
He's a dry drunk.
Yeah, he's a...
And this is how you can tell, is the beginning of the movie starts off with, I've done terrible things, and for redemption, I'm shucking a million oysters. And then literally, the minute he shucks this millionth oyster, he friggin' walks off the job and leaves his coworkers high and dry.
Yep.
And you think... And the first thing you think is, one, he's a jerk store. And then the second thing you think is, wow... I guess they don't work the program in Europe, because there's a whole thing about taking ownership for your actions and making amends.
The making amends portion, I believe, was left on the cutting room floor.
Well, no, he doesn't. And that is one of the reasons why Omar Sy tries to get some of his own back. Mm-hmm. And that character, I'm going to make the argument, there's a guy named Omar Sy, who's an actor.
He plays the sous chef.
And the reason he's the sous chef is he's brilliant, and also because the Bradley Cooper character sabotaged his restaurant on opening night one time by... calling a health inspector and then releasing a bunch of rats into the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And Bradley Cooper's like, yeah, well, bygones, you're brilliant. Cook for me, please. And so one night when two purported Michelin judges are there, Omar Sy deliberately sabotages their dishes and is like, okay, that's for the restaurant. But since it's Bradley Cooper's movie and therefore nothing can happen to him and he can't accrue any terrible consequences for a lifetime of dicking people around, it turns out that they were merely traveling salesmen. And I thought to myself, this poor Omar Sy character, he like tried to play the long game and he tried to get some of his own dignity back for the rage and humiliation he felt when this other person just callously wrecked his dreams. He thought he had a real chance to affect someone's life on a deep and visceral basis, and he threw it away on two traveling salesmen because he's not allowed any sort of catharsis or resolution for the very real damage that Bradley Cooper character wrought against him.
I enjoy that you've created this Wide Sargasso Sea version of Bert.
I created three separate Wide Sargasso Sea versions of Bert, because the first is the Omar Sy like thwarted revenge story. The second is Daniel Brühl's therapist finally points out to him that maybe he should stop giving Bradley Cooper so many chances because Bradley Cooper is never going to go gay, and so don't be in love with jerk stores.
Yeah,
and because the Daniel Brühl character plays somebody who is
in love with Bradley Cooper.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And the third movie is maybe Sienna Miller can go find herself a good barrister to sue the pants off of everybody after being relentlessly sexually harassed by her boss. He steals her ideas and then tries to inveigle her into a romantic relationship because that's the only way he can think to keep her in the kitchen.
Yep. So to wrap up the plot summary, basically...
Bradley Cooper is the worst in this movie.
A horrible man, like, somehow convinces everyone to come work for his restaurant where he is horrible to them, and yet they keep working there. Mm. And lo and behold, he does get that third Michelin star. And redemption is a story spelled COOPER.
Yeah. But there's literally nothing about this character to explain why other people put up with him for 5 minutes.
No.
What I was thinking about, this is kind of, this would be the culinary...
Our friend Brian, who, listener of the podcast, worked in the restaurant business, and he likes to point out that that chefs who yell and scream and throw plates, as Bradley Cooper does, in just an embarrassing scene.
Yeah.
People don't work for them because it's not...
Because there are other places
to go. There are other restaurants that are hiring,
If you're that skilled, you can go someplace else. Yeah. I was thinking some more about this today while I was driving in the rain. Mm-hmm. And so you and I watched Inside Llewyn Davis together, and we've chewed over that movie before.
Yep, on this very podcast.
And I thought to myself, you know, this movie would be, hear me out, would be the Inside Llewyn Davis of the culinary world type thing if, like the Coen Brothers movie, it was willing to stand back and let the viewer draw their own conclusions about the contents of people's characters, the complicity that the supporting characters have with regard to keeping the main character afloat as an awful human being, or the question, is it worth it? Is this a human endeavor that ultimately makes the world a better place? Because the Coen brothers, like, step back, let you view everything, and then you decide for yourself. But this movie unrelentingly from the first moment on lets you know you're supposed to be rooting for this jerk.
Oh yeah,
still.
No, this
you
is
are supposed to be totally okay with the fact that literally dozens of people have their livelihoods on the line for this jerk store.
Well, and he cooks a good fish, you know, and that goes a long way.
Yeah, I guess that's a skill you can't find anywhere in London.
No.
So, and you're supposed to accept that he's got some sort of talent that's so great that people are willing to forgive everything else. And this talent belongs to someone who's like, I don't want people to eat. I want them to, like, stop eating.
Eating, yes.
And the reason that character suffers so...
I don't want you to make them sick with longing. I don't want to eat at your restaurant.
Well, and I kept thinking, you know, we've watched how many seasons of Top Chef at this point?
Mm-hmm.
And
Top Chef Masters. One of the things that has struck with me about Top Chef Masters,
uh-huh.
And this is Jonathan Waxman, I believe, said this.
Yeah.
And side note, if Tom Colicchio ever decides that he's done with this reality show business, and he's quite good on the show.
They should have Jonathan Waxman.
They should have Jonathan Waxman. And Jonathan Waxman was talking about, look, the restaurant, is the root of that is restorative. And
yeah.
when people come into your place, they're supposed to feel warm and taken care of and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And that to me seems the guiding principle of food and not whatever weird shaman-like nonsense Bradley Cooper spews out of his pie hole for
what's really striking is Matthew Rhys is supposed to be his nemesis, his bête noir, and he basically like runs a restaurant that looks like it's from the year 2525. Mm-hmm. And
Matt is still alive,
and Bradley,
they will order food with chives in the year 2525.
But what I was about to say is,
in the year 3510. Man, we'll have a suckling hen. I'm sorry, I'm doing a... Okay, go on. I'm sorry.
You're giving me
a look. I'm just going to crawl into the corner here.
He's not looking at me, by the way. He's literally averting his eyes and starting to...
I'm shielding. I've got my glass of bourbon in between you and me.
The bourbon is smoking gently. Does it do that normally?
Sometimes.
But the point is that his kitchen is run... in a way that does seem restorative. And people in the year 2525 restaurant mm-hmm. actually seem really happy to be there. Whereas in the Bradley Cooper restaurant, like, no one is having a good time in that restaurant. And that kitchen, like, the only time they're united in solidarity is when they all agree that he's a jerk store for not letting the
Sienna Miller
character, like, have the day with her daughter for her daughter's birthday.
Yes.
Because he comes in and everyone's like, whatever, chef. And he's like, what happened? And they finally tell him, well, you're a jerk. And we all think you're a jerk. And...
So he makes the kid a cake,
and
that makes it all better. As he stares at this kid
with the look of a predator.
Yeah,
like
I kept expecting the Dateline NBC guy to pop up. So what are you doing here?
So it was just again, this movie could have worked if you were to step back and take a look at everyone's complicity in enabling this monster.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could debate for yourself whether or not, well, this person sticks to a singular vision. Is that worth it in this day and age? What does it cost for artistic integrity? Or what does hospitality mean? Blah, blah, blah. In a Llewyn Davis type of way. But instead, it is shot to, like he's shot in the most loving light possible.
Yep.
And all of the settings are sumptuous, and the point of view is, it's so unfair that the drug dealers to whom he still owes money are really angry about not being repaid, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's so unfair that his ex-girlfriend, who's also sober, is all, no, we really can't be together. And I'm like, no, you don't side with this. This is terrible.
Yeah.
You can side with people whose lives he upends, but you haven't given me a good reason to side with this dude. You have not made your case for why I should care about what happens to him.
So I have this theory about the movie.
Uh-huh.
That the way they got Bradley Cooper, who at the time that they filmed this, I think was a 2-time Oscar nominee.
Yeah.
And on his way to a 3rd Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
I think it was basically, you're not going to tell me how to act in this movie. I'm going to do my thing, and you're just going to sit back and yell, print it, baby. Because you and I commented as we were watching this terrible movie.
How peculiarly charmless.
How charmless, and how every decision that he made was terrible.
Yeah.
And how it actually made me rethink my assessment about Bradley Cooper as an actor.
Yeah.
Who, I up until this point, there's been things I've liked him in and things that I haven't. The things that I've liked him in have been American Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
Silver Linings Playbook.
I will also go to bat for Guardians of the Galaxy because that's a great voice performance.
It's a voice performance. It's different.
It's a good voice performance, yeah. though. Like, without the way that he plays it, because voice performances are super tricky, and without the way that he plays it, it wouldn't have worked as well.
Okay. Well, in the two movies that I liked him, they are shouty performances.
Yeah.
I always attributed that to David O. Russell.
Yeah.
And
well, I think the thing about Pat is very intense and very, very boundary violating, but he's also super duper vulnerable. And
this
has
is Silver Linings.
Silver Linings. And Pat's super duper vulnerable, and we are also allowed to see his flaws mm-hmm. and to judge for ourselves how many of Pat's problems are of his own doing and how many are outside his control. And then in American Hustle, the whole point of his character is just an amoral sleazeball.
Yeah.
So in both cases, it's a performance where you are allowed to see his vulnerability as well as the braggadocio and brashness and bravado and brrr words that he puts out front.
Yeah.
Whereas in this performance, he's a doctor and a lawyer and he can fly.
Yeah. So I guess I haven't seen American Sniper. I probably should
mm-hmm.
Before I make a judgment as to how much of this is how much of Bradley Cooper's good acting notices have been because of Bradley Cooper and how much have been source material
genuine
and
mastery
direction.
Of his craft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because honey,
let's look at Wet Hot American Summer.
He was very good in that.
Yeah.
He's very good in that. Okay. Yeah. That's something I liked him in. I hated him in Wedding Crashers.
Yeah. Well, you're supposed to.
Well, no, I hated him beyond just that guy. I hope he gets his. I thought, this is actually a performance that is
really off-putting.
Yeah, it's off-putting to the point of you need to call the cast and find out if they're okay.
Also, the thing that doesn't help this movie, in uh-huh. addition to the many, many things we listed above, is Bradley Cooper has already made his Troubled Chef coming out for redemption thing.
Well, yes, and where it was a comedy.
Where it was a sitcom with an infinitely charming supporting cast. And
Jack Bourdain!
Yeah, but it was...
We should, again, identify the work. It was Kitchen Confidential.
Kitchen Confidential.
Based on the Anthony Bourdain book, which I would actually recommend.
Yeah.
I would recommend...
And I'd recommend Kitchen Confidential as a fun watch.
And it used to be on Hulu.
Yeah, it might be on Netflix, mm-hmm. but it's got John Cho, it's got John Francis Daly, it's got Owain Yeoman, it's got Nicholas Brendan before he went off the rails, and it's just, the cast chemistry is unmistakable.
Frank Langella is in, like, the first episode or two.
Yeah, the writing is really sharp and funny, and Cooper does a much better job of playing somebody who deserves a second shot because he actually owns his mistakes, and he's come back from them having learned from them, and he's literally willing to break himself down and build himself back up. And
he's just better at comedy. Maybe he's got Brad Pitt disease.
Yeah. And that's what was lacking here is, I shucked a million oysters, so I guess I'm okay now. And I'm like, no, that's not how it works. That's not how any of this works. So,
You have to give 2 weeks' notice before you quit a job!
That's Red Skull is now like an employment counselor.
I feel like Red Skull could probably step in and help in this matter.
Yes.
But this entire movie just seemed to be reeking of it was conceived of, written, directed, and acted by people who literally cannot comprehend exactly like what kind of gilded bubble they all live in.
Yeah.
Like, the stakes are tiny.
Yep.
There's really nothing to root for here. There's no... There's no argument.
And the movie actually undermines the entire stakes because Emma Thompson character, who literally Emma Thompson
like showed up in her pajamas,
could not have given off more of a I can't be bothered cloud than she gives off in this movie. She goes, "What happens if you don't get that third star?" And his answer is,
"Yeah, I thought that the movie given." Spoiler alert, I thought that the movie giving him the third star was a really cheap move, because what I would like for it to have happened is for him to have still failed.
Yeah.
And then for him to have to actually reckon with who he is and rebuild from the ground up.
Yeah.
None of that happens.
No. No. So, yeah.
Anyway, the bright spot in the movie, and there was a bright spot. The bright spot is Daniel Brühl, who is basically in a different movie than the one that's actually being made, and his performance is nuanced, layered, heartbreaking, interesting, vulnerable, dignified, like, he is basically the personification of human decency in this movie, mm-hmm. and I could not take my eyes off him in every scene he was in.
Well, good for Daniel Brühl.
Yeah, I'm pretty much now going to obsessively hunt down what he's done in Netflix.
Oh, boy.
Well, the good news is this is not 2001 when Billy Crudup took over the DVR.
Yeah.
So this is 2016. He'll take over my Netflix queue, and yours shall remain unsullied.
Whereas Daniel Brühl is going to do a remake of Jesus' Son. I'll be, no!
Oh, jeez. I'm sorry I imposed Jesus' Son on you. I'm never going to hear the end of it. That's why I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Well, we all have our things.
Crosses to bear.
Yeah.
Womp womp.
Some of us impose burnt on other people. So.
Oh, you know, I had a wonderful time doing this with you. I had a wonderful time watching it with you. And again, I loved hearing from our audience.
Yeah.
So once more, a big thank you to those of you out there.
And if you want to, you know, pick up our mortgage or buy us dinner, that would also work.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have had drinks with listeners before.
Yes, we have, actually. So that's two interactions with listeners.
So, you know, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter if you're in the East Bay. We are happy to hang. We're not terrible people, I don't think.
No.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. We can retweet the glowing endorsements as they roll in or don't. But, you know, long story short, so we have a movie that one of us is looking forward to. We have a couple more previews we've ruined.
We can briefly do the things we've watched.
Sure.
Bit.
Sure.
Because I just watched 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Okay.
It's Kirk. It's a stellar cast for, you know, a live action Disney picture. It's Kirk Douglas, Peter Lorre, James Mason, Paul Lucas. It was also at the time, and I said this to you last night as I was finishing up the movie. Really, prior to Mary Poppins, Disney live action movies were ass. And it has its moments as a motion picture, but it's. It's not good.
No.
Mostly, I like it for inspiring this really obscure
SNL sketch.
Saturday Night Live sketch when Phil Hartman was still in the cast. Kelsey Grammer was the host, and it was Kelsey Grammer as Captain Nemo trying to explain to...
The difference between distance and
trying depth. To explain that a league is a distance and a fathom is depth, and Phil Hartman is the Kirk Douglas character, Rob Schneider is Peter Lorre,
I can just
Mike Myers is Paul Lucas, and they just are not getting it. And it's the stupidest idea for a sketch, and yet it worked.
Yeah.
So, that's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Me and the daughter watched Alice in Wonderland today because the Disney Corporation can't get enough of my money. And, you know, our daughter laughed at all the right places.
Oh, good.
Yeah, she really enjoyed it.
Who knew that she's developing critical faculties?
Yeah, Alice in Wonderland, the 1951 version, not the 2010 Johnny Depp live-action monstrosity.
Although Mia Wasikowska is a phenomenal actress and she doesn't disappoint in that version.
Everything about that movie disappointed me.
I will go.
But
to
I'm, that. A, I'm a big Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, you are. Whereas I will go to bat for Mia Wasikowska's performance, and I'll go to bat for Anne Hathaway's performance. I actually think that Anne Hathaway is a lot less lauded than she deserves to be, and I think it's because people really react to the whole drama kid tries very hard thing, whereas we like the myth that our thespians are a little bit distant and effortless or goofy cool girls or what have you.
Right.
But Anne Hathaway does a remarkable, wonderful, unearthly performance in that. And like I said, Mia Wasikowska, I've never seen a bad performance out of her.
Okay.
I recently rewatched two movies.
Okay, go ahead.
The first one I rewatched was Tracks with Mia Wasikowska.
Oh!
Where she plays a young woman named Robin who goes across the Australian outback accompanied only by four camels and a dog.
Okay.
And I find that movie very soothing. And bear in mind, I hate the desert, but
you do.
Yeah, but I find that movie very soothing because what it comes down to is how a person learns to strip their life down to the barest of essentials and rebuild themselves from the inside out. And you know, sometimes you just kind of need that sort of spare, plain, meditative, you know, journey, as it were. And the second one I watched was an Edward Norton Naomi Watts joint called The Painted Veil, where they are Edwardian and their marriage is troubled. And
as so many Edwardian marriages were.
And long story short, they finally get it together just to have one of them die in a plague. But
cool.
But the reason I liked watching that movie the first time because the performances they give one another are so darn good. It is such a pleasure to watch actors who are at the top of their craft playing off of somebody else who's also at the top of their craft.
Yeah.
And both of them are great here. And the reason I enjoy rewatching it now is because both of them were in Birdman, as a quarreling thespian couple. And so, you know, it's kind of funny watching the first movie now and then thinking about their scenes together in Birdman and hee-hee-hee-hee. But it was nice. And again, oh, and The Pain of Veil also takes place in China. So.
Okay. Oh, and I subjected you to a little bit of An American in Paris this week, which is the strangely lauded Gene Kelly 1950s musical that came out a year before. Singing in the Rain, American in Paris won Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as good as you might think.
I wouldn't call it subjected, but I do. I mean, the costuming is phenomenal.
The costuming is phenomenal. There are some great dance numbers.
I love the arts. I love the art student ball set.
I don't care for Vincent Minnelli as a director.
No.
And Gene Kelly has no supporting cast in this one.
No, you also really didn't care for.
I don't like Leslie Caron.
Yeah. You have. What's interesting about your approach to 1950s movies is so many of the leading actresses who were not in noir, I hasten to add, because noir is a whole different genre.
Yeah,
but very much so. So many of the actresses leave you cold.
Yep.
Like there's that Hitchcock movie that I'm blanking on with Doris Day in it.
Oh, the Man Who Knew Too Much.
And I watched that with you and watched you grimace through every one of her scenes. Like, you just do not do Doris Day.
No. Who does?
And, don't.
No, I'm not gonna. And, there's a Paul Lynde joke I would have made here.
No.
Do a Google search for Paul Lynde and Doris Day.
No. Yeah, but, no, don't do it.
And Dinah Shore.
Oh, for God's sake. Yeah, I have to see. We have queued up on the DVR because I think right now it's all of my TV shows and all your movies. And we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Okay. And our tour of the classics will continue.
Yes.
I am going to make you watch This Is Where I Leave You.
Yeah, I think actually Mad Max Fury Road is on the docket soon.
I saw a credits re-edit of that with the opening of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, so yeah. I will be greatly disappointed if that doesn't come to pass.
Well, then. I think disappointment is in your future.
When is it not?
Yeah.
All right. In any event, we've carried on long enough. Again, I want to thank you guys for your listening. It means so much that you were willing to take time and money out of your busy lives to engage on this burnt journey with us.
Mm-hmm.
If anything similar comes up in the future, you will all be the first to know. But wrapping up this episode of Lisa and Phil and Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies, I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
I'm Philip Michaels. Please send us a better movie next time.